George Kennan, and Henry Kissinger. It was a vision of international relations formed from experience rather than reading, confirmed by early encounters with hardship and imminent death, rooted in a relentlessly realistic view of human nature. The foreign policy sections of the farewell address were only a part, in fact the lesser part, of what he intended to say. His major point is difficult for us to hear, because the vision he projects has long since arrived, making it hard to appreciate the time when the vision remained visionary. Our eyes run quickly over those paragraphs urging New Englanders and Virginians to think of themselves as Americans, to understand their regional differences as complementary strengths in a flourishing national mosaic. The one brief section that Hamilton kept deleting and Washington kept restoring called for a national university in the new capital, Washington's old request, designed to congregate the rising generation of future leaders on common ground. These national exhortations were not affirmations of what we were, but rather pleadings for what we must become. In this sense, the farewell address was primarily a great prophecy that the first word in the term United States was destined to trump the second. As a historical argument, this was a frontal assault on the Republican interpretation of all that the American Revolution meant. The following passage was designed to make Jefferson and his colleagues squirm. "This government, the offspring of our own choice, uninfluenced and unawed, adopted upon full investigation and mature deliberation, completely free in its principles, in the distribution of its owners, uniting security with energy, and containing within itself a provision for its own amendment, has first claim to your confidence and support. The very idea of the power and right of the people to establish government presupposes the duty of every individual to obey the established government." Here was the lesson Washington had learned commanding the Continental Army. American independence, if it were to endure, required a federal government capable of coercing the states to behave responsibly. This put him squarely at odds with the Republican argument that a sovereign national government violated the spirit of 76. In the farewell address, Washington reiterated his conviction that the centralizing impulses of the American Revolution were not violations, but fulfillments of its original ethos. As one who could claim considerable credibility on the question, he was planting his standard squarely in the national camp and urging his fellow American citizens to rally around him. Apart from its core message, independence abroad and unity at home, the farewell address was a personal assertion of competence. All those rumors of creeping senility and fading mental powers would be forced to encounter the old commander-in-chief, still very much in charge. He was going out as he came in, dignified, defiant, and decisive, clear about what was primary, what peripheral, confident about where history was headed. Two huge subjects, slavery and Indian policy, are conspicuously missing from the farewell address, primarily because Washington wanted to sound a unifying note, and these topics had proved resistant to compromise or even conversation. by insisting that the federal government was the legitimate expression of America's revolutionary intentions. He implicitly recognized that both forbidden subjects should be addressed at the federal rather than state level. This was precisely the point the Republicans contested so fiercely, at least in part because it threatened to place slavery on the national agenda beyond the control of the planter class living south of the Potomac. But Washington himself had conceded that slavery was the one issue that could not be pushed forward without placing the entire national experiment at risk. His silence on the subject in the farewell address accurately reflected his judgment that debate over slavery must be postponed for at least a generation. He did not feel the same way about the Indian question. In August 1796, while making final revisions in the farewell address, Washington decided to publish an open letter to the Cherokee Nation. No tribe had done as much as the Cherokees to accommodate itself to white encroachments on its tribal land and to adapt its own customs and mores to permit peaceful coexistence with the advancing wave of white settlements. "I have thought much on this subject," Washington explained, "and anxiously wished that these various Indian tribes, as well as their neighbors, the white people, might enjoy in abundance all the good things which make life comfortable and happy." He saw the Cherokees as perhaps the best hope for making his vision of sovereign Indian enclaves within the United States a reality. If the Cherokees would continue to do their part, Washington promised them that the federal government would enforce the treaties honorably so as to assure Cherokee survival as a people and a nation. Washington described his commitment as a matter of law as well as a personal promise. He meant every word, and the Cherokees responded by accepting it as the sacred vow of the retiring white father. But despite his sincerity and personal commitment, this was one promise that even Washington could not keep. In his final address to Congress, he sounded an upbeat note. British troops were evacuating their western posts. Border disputes in Maine and Florida were being sensibly adjudicated. The economy was humming along nicely. A new treaty with the Creeks offered hope for an end to frontier violence in the Southwest. The only dark cloud, French raids on American shipping in the Caribbean, was regretful, but surely the French would come to their senses. The tone was patriarchal, as if a father granted custody of an infant child was reporting proudly that the child was doing well and was now safely past its infancy. Then Washington made several specific recommendations. The nation desperately needed a small navy to police its coastline and protect American commerce from predatory Islamic pirates in the Mediterranean. It also needed a national military academy to provide a professional officer class for the Army and, the old plea, a national university on the Potomac. Congress should also consider legislation to encourage the country's nascent but latent manufacturing sector. Federal subsidies to encourage improved agricultural techniques were also a shrewd investment, as were increased salaries for federal employees in order to assure recruitment of the most able citizens. All in all, it was a call for an expanded federal mandate, so robust that nothing like it would be proposed again until John Quincy Adams assumed the presidency in 1824. The Republicans had always described such federal initiatives as Hamiltonian. The outgoing president wished to leave no doubt that they had always been Washingtonian as well. Though he liked to think of himself and his presidency as above the fray, he was going out as an avowed Federalist. Indeed, he suggested that his departure from the national scene would require even greater enlargements of federal power to compensate for his absence, that his retirement necessitated the creation of centering forces institutionalized at the federal level to sustain the focusing functions he had performed personally. His correspondence during his last months in office makes no mention of the ongoing election to choose his successor. Jefferson carried the same studied detachment to an extreme, claiming that he did not even realize that he was a candidate. Washington was surely pleased when Adams won a narrow electoral victory, since it meant a continuation of Federalist policies. But his expression of congratulation was deliberately restrained and official. His one piece of advice to Adams was to retain John Quincy, his son, in the Foreign Service, despite the inevitable accusations of nepotism. Showing that his eye for young talent remained sharp, Washington described the younger Adams as a precocious lad who would prove himself to be the ablest of all in the diplomatic corps. Otherwise, he busied himself in packing for the move back to Mount Vernon, drafting final commands to the commissioners at Federal City to focus all their energies on the completion of the capital, complaining that the French Directory was misnamed because it lacked any sense of direction, and ordering new dentures to replace the temporary set, which did not fit and caused his lips to protrude discernibly in a way he found embarrassing. The last days were spent hosting dinners and dances in his honor. The ceremonials culminated with the Adams inauguration, where, somewhat to Adams's irritation, more attention was paid to the outgoing than incoming president. Adams reported to Abigail that he thought he heard Washington murmuring under his breath at the end of the ceremony, I am fairly out and you fairly in. See which of us will be the happiest. But the story is probably apocryphal. Washington's diary entry for that day was typically flat and unrevealing. Much such a day as yesterday in all respects, Mercury at 41. The public man was already receding into the proverbial mists. The private man could not wait to get those new dentures and place himself beneath those vines and fig trees. Chapter 7. Testament. The vine and fig tree motif suggested bucolic splendor, afternoon naps in the shade, relaxed routines aligned with the undulating contours of rolling hills. Nothing could have been more alien to Washington's temperament. "We are all on litter and dirt," he explained less than a month after his retirement, "occasioned by joiners, masons, and painters working in the house, all part of which, as well as the outbuildings, I find upon examination to be exceedingly out of repair." While he had been tending to the business of the nation, no one had tended to the business of Mount Vernon, at least according to his own exacting standards. The required renovations meant hiring a small army of carpenters and painters, then adjusting to the chaos created by what he called the music of hammers or the odoriferous smell of paint. A day in the life of George Washington in retirement began at 5 o'clock with the rising of the sun. "If my hirelings are not in their places at that time, I send them messages of my sorrow for their indisposition." In other words, he woke them up. then provided meticulous instructions about their respective assignments for the day. At 7 o'clock, he ate a light breakfast, often corn cakes lathered with butter and honey, cut in thin slices in order to limit the work required of his ill-fitting dentures and swollen gums. Then he was on horseback, riding around his farms for 6 hours, ordering drainage ditches to be widened, inspecting the operation of a new distillery he had recently constructed on the premises, warning poachers that the deer on his property had become domesticated and must not be hunted, inquiring after a favored house slave who had recently been bitten by a mad dog. He arrived back at the mansion at 2 o'clock. No one needed to take the reins of his horse. Washington simply slapped him on the backside, and he trotted over to the barn on his own. Horses, like men, seemed disposed to acknowledge his authority. He then dressed for dinner at 3 o'clock sharp, which usually featured multiple courses and multiple guests, some of whom were perfect strangers who had made the pilgrimage to Mount Vernon to witness the great man in the flesh, and could not be turned away without violating the open-ended Virginia code of hospitality. As a living legend, Washington recognized that he remained public property, though even he observed that it was somewhat disconcerting to realize that he and Martha had not sat down for a meal by themselves in over 20 years. Even the sheer gawkers, he acknowledged, came out of respect to me, then added, "Would not the word curiosity answer as well?" After dinner, he liked to show guests his collection of medals, the key to the Bastille sent by Lafayette, and prints done by John Trumbull depicting famous battles in the War of Independence. All this done with becoming modesty about his own contribution to the cause. He then led his guests to the piazza facing the Potomac, where he paced back and forth and liked to talk about farming, plow designs, the dreaded Hessian fly, crop rotation schemes. He often enjoyed an after-dinner glass of Madeira, which he held casually with his arm draped over a chair, while listening impassively to any political talk that he preferred to avoid. Awkward silences did not disturb him, and one guest, expecting a more engaged conversationalist, expressed disappointment that he did not at any time speak with any remarkable fluency. On the other hand, several visitors reported that he went on at considerable length about the obvious advantage of placing a national university in the still unfinished federal city. A visiting Polish nobleman also described him delivering an impassioned soliloquy on the destructive consequences of the French Revolution and the tragic fate of his beloved Lafayette, who was still imprisoned in Austria. It was his custom to leave his guests at about 5 o'clock in order to spend 2 hours in his study, writing letters and reading one or more of the 10 newspapers to which he subscribed. At 7, he reappeared for tea, bowed to the ladies, then resumed pacing and chatting with the men. He and Martha retired at 9 for the night, leaving first-time visitors with the distinct impression that they had been privileged to witness the most commanding physical presence on the planet in its most natural habitat. At least on the physical side, appearances were not wholly deceptive. Throughout his final retirement, Washington experienced no debilitating injury or discernible deterioration of his mental or physical powers. The long midday ride provided more exercise than he could manage during the presidency, making him more trim and fit than he had been in 8 years. In 1798, he estimated his weight at 210 pounds. To be sure, the creases around his eyes continued to deepen. His hair, though still full, was now completely gray. And he turned down an invitation to the annual ball in Alexandria by claiming that neither he nor Martha could move on the dance floor with their previous elegance. But he was, in fact, aging gracefully. Putting the lie to all those Jeffersonian rumors of his imminent descent into decrepitude and senility. Friends who recommended special diets or health potions received a polite rebuttal that suggested a man at peace with his mortality. Against the effect of time and age, no remedy has yet been discovered, and like the rest of my fellow mortals, I must, if life is prolonged, submit. His stoicism on this score was real, not a brave pose. When the Grim Reaper eventually came to claim him, he was vulnerable only because he had insisted on making his daily rounds with utter disdain for a raging sleet storm that drove everyone else to cover. Two shadows loomed over his serenity during his final retirement. The first came from those fields and farms he inspected every day. For visitors, Mount Vernon was a mansion, a national shrine with a majestic view of the Potomac that visually embodied the majesty of their host and hero. For Washington, Mount Vernon was the land and all its occupants beyond the mansion, which posed problems that no amount of carpentry or fresh coats of paint could cure. An inventory done in April 1797 by James Anderson, the new and forever beset manager at Mount Vernon, revealed a collection of farms containing 123 horses, mules, and asses, 680 cattle and sheep, and approximately 300 slaves, of which only 100 were fully employed, the rest being too old, too young, or too sick to do a day's work. Economically, Mount Vernon had long ceased to be a plantation in the Tidewater mode with tobacco or wheat as its chief cash crop. It had become a highly diversified collection of farms dedicated to multiple crops and livestock, much of which were consumed on the premises. Two overlapping and interacting questions preoccupied Washington on his daily rides. What could be done with the land to transform the lethal chemistry of high expenses and negligible or non-existent profits? And what should be done with those 300 black residents of Mount Vernon, whom he could not in good conscience sell without breaking up families, could not afford to keep without enlarging his annual costs, and whose very presence constituted a massive contradiction of the principles on which his heroic reputation rested. The other shadow came from the direction of Philadelphia, where the prospects of war with France and the increasingly partisan political battles between Federalists and Republicans formed ominous clouds that soon drifted over Mount Vernon. Being an ex-president proved just as unprecedented as being president. Kings and emperors did not have the problem, since they always died in office or exile, whereas Washington remained alive and lurking in the middle distance. He had come out of retirement twice before, in 1787 to chair the Constitutional Convention, and in 1789 to head the national government. The pressure to extend this pattern, or else witness the dissolution of all that he had worked for as commander-in-chief and then president, mounted throughout 1797. His response to that pressure proved to be the poorest judgment of his political career, for he allowed himself to become a pawn in a dangerous scheme that threatened the Republican experiment and eventually killed the Federalist Party. A Useful Aegis. Even before Washington settled into his retirement routine, Jefferson made a shrewd prediction about the post-Washington political world. The president is fortunate to get off as the bubble is bursting, leaving others to hold the bag. Yet, as his departure will mark the moment when the difficulties begin to work, you will see that they will be ascribed to the new administration. Jefferson even claimed that he felt relieved to have lost the presidential election to Adams, who now faced the shadow of Washington problem, as well as the legacy of a looming war with France, all amidst an increasingly shrill press. Before the Aurora shifted its guns toward Adams, it fired one final salvo at Washington himself that accurately previewed the escalating character of the verbal warfare that would rage for the next 4 years. Tom Paine wrote an open letter to Washington in which he actually prayed for his imminent death, then wondered out loud, "Whether the world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles or whether you ever had any." Other editorials described Washington as a tyrannical monster and his farewell address as the loathings of a sick mind. Washington, for his part, pretended not to notice. Letters going out from Mount Vernon repeated the major themes of the farewell address, neutrality abroad and unity at home, and urged that instead of being Frenchmen or Englishmen in politics, all citizens come together as Americans. He regretted the partisan bickering and personal invective, which now he claimed had the faint sound of cannon shots in the distance. "Having taken my seat in the shade of my vine and fig tree," he postured, "I shall endeavor to view things in the calm lights of mild philosophy." This was not what he truly felt or thought. A visitor who accompanied him on a tour of the construction sites in Federal City reported that Washington could joke about the unfinished buildings, suggesting the congressmen and senators might have to camp out for a few years. But when the subject of French attacks on American shipping came up, he went into a tirade about the destructive consequences of the French Revolution. "I never heard him speak with so much candor," observed the witness, "nor with such heat." A more private outburst occurred in March 1798, when James Monroe published a lengthy defense of his conduct as American minister to France. He described his insubordination as a higher form of patriotism and Washington's decision to remove him as a treasonable act. Washington went into his study, venting his anger in a line-by-line critique of Monroe's pamphlet that was more sarcastic and scathing than anything he had ever written. Finally, in the same month, he denounced Jefferson more directly than he had ever done before. The specific occasion was a strange incident involving Jefferson's nephew, Peter Carr, who hatched a misguided plan to write Washington under a pseudonym in the hope of eliciting a response that might generate incriminating evidence of Washington's anti-French sentiments the Republican press could then circulate. Nothing came of this, though Washington endorsed his informant's characterization of Jefferson as one of the most artful, intriguing, industrious, and double-faced politicians in America. Whether Jefferson was directly involved in this plot to stigmatize Washington is unclear. But Washington's willingness to believe so put yet another nail in the coffin of their relationship, and unleashed a diatribe against Jefferson's integrity more explicit than anything he had permitted himself during his presidency. His letters began to describe the French Party, or the Bacheites, as a well-organized conspiracy determined to destroy what he had painstakingly achieved over 8 years of nation-building, and to smear anyone, himself included, who stood in its way. He told Lafayette that a party exists in the United States formed by a combination of causes who oppose the government in all its measures, and are determined, as all their conduct evinces, by clogging its wheels, indirectly to change the nature of it, and to subvert the Constitution. Some of the conspirators, he claimed, wanted to turn the clock back to 1787, thereby repudiating the hard-won constitutional settlement. Others hoped to return to 1776, an urge that Washington regarded as a death wish for any national union. Moreover, at least as he saw it, those orchestrating this conspiracy were devoid of honor or any principle except the acquisition of power. They had seized upon the pro-French sentiment of the American populace during the debate over the Jay Treaty. But they would have grabbed at anything, he claimed, that served as an instrument to facilitate the destruction of their own government. Their purported affection for France was a disingenuous ploy, for they had no more regard for that nation than for the Grand Turk, farther than their own views were promoted by it. And they had seen fit to release their running dogs in the Aurora to libel him. Even though the two chief conspirators, Jefferson's and Madison's names were too painful to mention, knew that Bache and his minions were practicing character assassination against a man the Virginians purported to admire. What could Jefferson and Madison have said in response to this indictment? Surely they would not have recognized themselves as the political villains Washington described. Probably they would have explained the accusations as clinching evidence that the aging patriarch had completely lost his mind. But in truth, Jefferson and Madison were so caught up in their conspiratorial indictment of the Federalists that they lacked any perspective on how their own conduct appeared when seen from the enemy's camp. Though there was a discernibly personal edge to Washington's charges, the political wounds inflicted on him during his second term by the Republican press still festered. Jefferson and Madison had, in fact, been orchestrating a concerted and often covert campaign against the Federalists since 1791. They had played politics with foreign policy during the debate over the Jay Treaty. They had paid scandalmongers to libel Hamilton and Washington. And they had, on several occasions, as in the Genet affair, endorsing Monroe's conduct in Paris, engaged in skullduggery that would have been regarded as treasonable in any modern court of law. Doubtless Jefferson would have been able to pass a lie detector test, disavowing any knowledge of behind-the-scenes mischief, and would have then mounted an eloquent defense of the elevated principles governing his conduct and the Republican agenda. But Washington's rebuttal would have enjoyed the benefit of a substantial body of historical evidence, documenting what Jefferson, in another context, had described as a long train of abuses. All of which helps to explain what is otherwise inexplicable, and a major deviation from Washington's usual pattern of behavior, namely, his decision to lend his name and prestige to a Federalist plot, whether it was a full-fledged conspiracy remained shrouded in mystery, designed to establish a standing army that could, among other uses, intimidate and eventually crush the Republican opposition. In the spring of 1798, President Adams released decoded dispatches revealing that the French Directory had demanded a £50,000 bribe as a precondition for negotiating with three envoys Adams had sent to Paris in order to seek a diplomatic solution to the ongoing crisis. Labeled the XYZ affair, a reference to the initials used by the French operatives demanding the bribe, the revelations produced a dramatic reversal in public opinion toward France and a surge of hostility toward French supporters in America. Abigail Adams reported one 4th of July toast, "John Adams, may he, like Samson, slay thousands of Frenchmen with the jawbone of Jefferson." Anti-Jefferson editorials described him as the covert leader of the Frenchified faction in this country and the secret head of the American Directory. War hysteria mounted as newspapers reported the existence of a 50,000-man French army purportedly poised to cross the Atlantic and invade the United States. Washington's initial response to the hysteria was characteristically measured. He thought the prospects of a French invasion were remote in the extreme, concurring with Adams's more colorful assessment that seeing a French army in America was like imagining a snowball in Philadelphia at the height of summer. He did take some delight at the plight of Bache and his fellow scandalmongers at the Aurora, who were surrounded by a hostile mob after suggesting that the United States pay the bribe demanded by the French in order to avert war. And, more tellingly, he tacitly endorsed four pieces of legislation rushed through Congress by Federalist extremists and known collectively as the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were designed to deport foreign-born residents suspected of French sympathies and shut down newspapers publishing any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States. Adams subsequently, if grudgingly, acknowledged that signing the Alien and Sedition Acts was the biggest blunder of his presidency. And historians have almost unanimously concluded that these statutes deserve to live in infamy as blatant examples of flagrant government repression. But they did not appear flagrant to Washington at the time, convinced, as he was, and not without reason, that the Republicans had been waging a subversive campaign for many years against the very legitimacy of the elected government. In retrospect, the Federalists were exploiting the anti-French hysteria in the same partisan fashion that the Republicans had exploited the pro-French hysteria during the debate over the Jay Treaty. But the Federalists were also crossing a line they had never crossed as long as they enjoyed Washington's leadership. Namely, they were aiming to silence their political opponents. It is intriguing, though in the end futile, to speculate whether they would have overreached so fatally if Washington had remained in office, or if Washington himself would have thought differently if located in Philadelphia at the center of the deliberations. What can be said with certainty is that Washington cheered the ill-starred Federalist campaign from the sidelines. The plot had already begun to thicken even before passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts. In May 1798, Congress had approved the creation of 10 new regiments, more than 10,000 men, for what was described as the Provisional Army. The name conveyed the conditional character of the military commitment, which was contingent upon the threat of a French invasion. Additional legislation permitted the recruitment of an additional 20 regiments if and when a French fleet actually materialized off the American coast. Soon thereafter, Washington received a letter from Hamilton, warning him that duty was about to call him out of retirement again. "You ought to be aware, my dear sir, that in the event of an open rupture with France, the public voice will again call you to command the armies of your country." Washington's initial response was dismissive. The prospect of a French army crossing the Atlantic still struck him as highly unlikely, especially since the French were fully engaged with the British in Europe. And even if war should occur, the American commander should be someone younger, a man more in his prime. Indeed, Washington concluded, he would regard another call to service much as I would go to the tombs of my ancestors. But he left the door slightly ajar. Throughout the summer of 1798, Washington came under increasing pressure from Hamilton, and two members of Adams's cabinet, Secretary of State Timothy Pickering and Secretary of War James McHenry, to take the French threat seriously. They urged him to make two commitments. First, to agree to serve, if only provisionally, as commander of the Provisional Army, meaning he would not need to take the field unless and until hostilities commenced. Second, to appoint Hamilton as his next in command and, as Pickering put it, the chief in your absence. Washington should have sensed that something was awry at this moment, since the urgency of the political pressure he was receiving was at odds with the urgency of the strategic threat it was designed to meet. But he did not. On July 11th, McHenry appeared at Mount Vernon to make a personal appeal, which produced reluctant consent from Washington. Again, on the condition that he need not budge from Mount Vernon until the army is in a situation to require my presence or it becomes indispensable by the urgency of circumstances. As for Hamilton's rank, Washington thought it made eminent sense, but he needed to apprise Henry Knox of the decision, since Knox had outranked Hamilton in the previous war and might be offended at serving under him in any subsequent conflict. Knox responded immediately, deeply wounded at the suggestion of deferring to what he caustically described as the transcendent military talents of Colonel Hamilton. Then Knox expressed bewilderment at this rush to judgment, both to create an army and to elevate Hamilton to its head, and confided that he smelled something foul lurking in the background, speculating that there has been a species of management in this affair of which you are not apprised. Washington wrote back plaintively to Knox, disappointed that he had taken the rank matter so personally, and assuring him that if there was any management in this business, it has been concealed from me. There was, and it had. In collusion with disaffected and disloyal members of Adams's cabinet, Hamilton had hatched a scheme to transform the Provisional Army into a permanent military establishment and an instrument for his expanded power within the Federalist Party. To be fair, Hamilton had convinced himself that Napoleon's imperial ambitions did include North America, not an implausible conviction, and that he alone possessed the vision and energy not only to thwart such threats, but also to out-Napoleon Napoleon himself. In typical Hamiltonian fashion, his plans were quite grandiose. If his letters to fellow Federalists are to be believed, he envisioned marching his army through Virginia, thereby intimidating the Republican leadership in its major sanctuary, then launching a preemptive invasion of Florida and the Louisiana Territory, where French and Spanish residents would be offered citizenship in a vastly expanded American empire, then marching his force southward through Mexico and Central America. Washington was unwittingly providing the imprimatur of his name to this wild scheme. And by insisting on Hamilton's appointment as his second-in-command, then refusing to take the field while the army was being raised, Washington was inadvertently playing directly into Hamilton's hands. 2 years later, after Washington's death, Hamilton made the remarkable comment, "He was a useful aegis to me." This was perhaps the moment he had in mind. At any rate, the moment exposed the dangerous tendencies of Hamilton's genius once released from Washington's control. There is little question that Washington would have condemned the more bizarre features of Hamilton's plan if he had known what was afoot. True enough, he believed in the creation of national institutions that would focus the energies of a far-flung population, a capital city, a national university, the national bank, a conspicuous chief executive. He also favored a modest expansion of the regular army, along with a military academy to educate a new corps of professional officers. But a permanent standing army marching across the countryside conjured up the kind of menacing and thoroughly coercive embodiment of government power that epitomized the dreaded consolidation the Republicans had always been warning against. Washington's entire presidency had been spent assuring the citizenry that such fears were unfounded, hyperbolic, and politically motivated. Now, with one bold stroke, Hamilton was inadvertently undoing all of Washington's painstaking work. Almost as bad, Washington's complicity in the plot lent credibility to the Republican claim that the old patriarch was a rather dazed front man for the conspiratorial manipulations of an evil genius behind the curtain. Hamilton's scheme hit a snag in the fall of 1798, when Adams insisted on ranking Knox as second in command. Pickering explained to Washington that the president has an extreme aversion to Colonel Hamilton, a personal resentment, and if allowed his own wishes and feelings alone, would scarcely have given him the rank of brigadier. Again, Washington was called to the rescue. Again, he played his appointed role. And again, he should have known better. Pickering and McHenry explained that Adams would be forced to reverse his decision once Washington made it abundantly clear that Hamilton was his own unequivocal choice. Washington complied, providing Adams with a description of Hamilton that probably prompted one of Adams's Vesuvial eruptions. It was also a characterization that an elder statesman might have made of a younger Washington. "By some, he is considered as an ambitious man, and therefore a dangerous one. That he is ambitious, I shall readily grant, but it is of that laudable kind which prompts a man to excel in whatever he takes in hand. He is enterprising, quick in his perceptions, and his judgment intuitively great. Qualities essential in a great military character, and therefore I repeat that his loss will be irreparable." Adams was just beginning to suspect that members of his own cabinet were engaged in behind-the-scenes plotting with Hamilton. But he could not afford to alienate America's preeminent hero. By forcing Hamilton on him, Washington violated the cardinal rule for all ex-presidents: never interfere with the decisions of your successor. And Adams, who believed that holding grudges was a measure of personal integrity, never forgave him for this. It finally began to dawn on Washington that he was engaged in clandestine conversations with a hostile faction of Adams's cabinet. "You will readily perceive," he wrote McHenry, "that even the rumor of a misunderstanding between the president and me would be attended with unpleasant consequences." He asked McHenry to destroy all copies of their recent correspondence that mentioned Adams, warning that their publication may induce him to believe in good earnest that intrigues are carrying on in which I am an actor, than which nothing is more foreign from my heart. However sincere, this was a naive sentiment, which we know about only because McHenry ignored the request and saved all the letters. Knowing as we do that the French invasion was a mirage, and that Hamilton was fully prepared to exploit it for personal and political purposes, Washington's blinkered response to the ongoing intrigue becomes difficult to explain, except, perhaps, as a serious lapse in judgment occasioned by his dwindling powers of concentration, his distance from political headquarters in Philadelphia, and his excessive trust in Hamilton's motives. Such an explanation, in fact, captures a lion's share of the truth, and therefore must serve as a somewhat sad, near-the-end exception to an impressive list of extraordinarily prescient judgments made when a misstep of equivalent magnitude would have possibly put the survival of the Republic at risk. What the explanation misses, and the irony here runs deep, is how Washington's previous experience helped lead him astray in this instance. Both sides, Federalists and Republicans, believed that the fate of the Republic was very much at risk in 1798. Both sides viewed the crisis through the prism of the American Revolution. The Republicans saw the Provisional Army, now being referred to as the New Army, an ominous acknowledgment that it was intended to remain intact forevermore, as a domestic version of the standing army the British had imposed on the colonies in the 1770s. The Federalists saw it as the second coming of the Continental Army, which had not only won an improbable victory over Great Britain, but also had provided the only reliable source of national unity when all else was collapsing in huge heaps of political and economic chaos. Washington was uniquely vulnerable to the Federalist interpretation, since it touched all the patriotic chords that reverberated in his memory and aligned itself with the storyline that had defined the shaping experience of his public life. The fact that it recast the elder statesman in his more youthful role as savior of the embattled Republic only added to its psychological appeal. Part of its appeal to Hamilton was that it allowed the surrogate son to assume the patriarchal role as commander-in-chief. The potency of the old revolutionary memories was put on graphic display in November 1798 when Washington traveled to Philadelphia, the only time he ranged very far from Mount Vernon during his retirement. He had agreed to confer with Hamilton and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, South Carolina's contribution to the triumvirate of the new army, all Revolutionary War veterans who spent 10 hours a day for 6 weeks huddled over lists of candidates for the new officers' corps. It quickly became clear that the Continental Army would be the model for the new army, and that previous service in the old army would be the chief criterion for inclusion in the new one. Although several battle-scarred veterans were judged to be over the hill, younger men who lacked the revolutionary credentials were deemed untrustworthy. Washington's memory of old comrades in arms was prodigious, reflected in the detailed notes he made on more than 60 candidates based on their conduct under his eye during the War of Independence. "Unquestioned bravery and great popularity," read one entry. "But a great gambler, and weighs 400 or 500 pounds, good for nothing." Washington also placed an order with a Philadelphia tailor for an exact replica of his old buff and blue uniform, complete with precise specifications about the cuffs, buttons, sashes, and embroidery to assure an authentic match. The tailor was able to come up with all the items except the gold thread for the embroidery. Then, when a special shipment of the proper thread arrived from New York, the tailor was forced to tell Washington that he could not find an embroiderer capable of duplicating the design perfectly, so the uniform was never completed. This little episode served as a nice metaphor for the larger project of recreating the Continental Army. Memories of the old band of brothers were palpable for Washington, but the world had moved on, and the ghosts from a glorious past could never return except in memory. The new army, in fact, was destined to remain just as incomplete and fanciful as Washington's new uniform. Adams was determined to see to that. He never believed the French intended to invade America, and if they ever did, he preferred a naval buildup, what he called wooden walls, to an enlarged army, which he associated with the much-feared standing armies of English and European history. Though he was slow to realize the full extent of the plotting between Hamilton and members of his cabinet, his antennae perked up as the enormous scale of planning for the new army took shape. Moreover, his personal loathing for Hamilton made him suspicious in all the ways that Washington was gullible. In February 1799, he stunned Federalists and Republicans alike by announcing his decision to send another peace commission to France. With this simple stroke, Adams eliminated the prospect of war and thereby destroyed the rationale for the new army. Though it would take several months before the peace commission was dispatched to Paris, all of Hamilton's hopes for military glory died with Adams's decision. So, for that matter, did Adams's hopes for re-election, since he immediately became a pariah within the Federalist Party. But Adams never regretted the decision, indeed always described it as the crowning moment of his presidency. For over a year, Hamilton continued to work feverishly on the logistical and organizational details for a phantom army that chiefly existed only in his own imagination. Washington, for his part, began to back away from the floundering project. He questioned the impulsiveness of the Adams decision, never fully understanding how Adams had in fact rescued him from an embarrassing blunder and the nation itself from a dangerous brush with martial law. He remained oblivious to the political machinations that had gone on behind the scenes to manipulate his cooperation, until McHenry inadvertently provided him with a candid account of the rampant subversion within the Adams cabinet. "I have been stricken dumb," he confessed upon receiving the news, "and I believe it better that I should remain mute than to express any sentiment on the important matters which are related therein." He vowed never again to allow himself to be drawn into any decisions facing the executive branch. "I shall trust to the mariners, whose duty is to watch, to steer it into a safe port." His remaining energies, he also realized, had plenty of problems to focus on within the expansive confines of Mount Vernon. Entangling alliances. The problems came at him from multiple angles and in various sizes and shapes. The steady procession of house guests that made Mount Vernon a hotel and Washington himself a perpetual host. The endless negotiations about building lots and construction schedules at Federal City. The ominously familiar conduct of George Washington Parke Custis, his step-grandson, son of Jackie, who dropped out of the College of New Jersey, Princeton, then idled away his days in a sullen stupor. All despite Washington's best efforts at mentoring, and who seemed committed to the same downward trajectory as his father. The routine requests for financial assistance from indigent relatives and utter strangers pleading their plight. Washington's correspondence during his final retirement conjures up the picture of a beleaguered patriarch, juggling his duties with due diligence, parceling out the pieces of his time and energy like an overscheduled chief executive no longer protected by a small army of secretaries, the ultimate embodiment of self-control, who now found himself, near the end, completely controlled by the agenda of others. But appearances in this instance are somewhat misleading, because the demand-driven character of Washington's correspondence is not a reliable guide to what was on his mind. Nor, for that matter, is it an accurate measure of his silent determination to exercise control over the one problem he cared about most. That problem could be summed up in one word, and Washington's preference for a euphemism, that species of property, only confirms, albeit in a backhanded way, how much the unmentionable subject haunted him in those last years. "I shall frankly declare," he confessed to one friend, "that I do not like to think, much less talk, about it." But it was an inescapable presence that enveloped his day-by-day experience from the moment he walked out the front door of his mansion until he returned from his midday ride around his farms. The last time Washington had given slavery his full attention was during his first retirement in the 1780s. Three salient points are worth noticing about his thinking at this earlier stage.